Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. As North America veers away from oil and coal, so-called natural gas is being promoted as a green bridge fuel to a renewable future. Such is the reasoning behind massive gas projects being proposed for the Pacific Northwest, such as the world's largest methanol refinery in Kalama, Washington, the first West Coast LNG export terminal proposed for Coos Bay, Oregon, and a complex hybrid LNG storage and bunkering facility in Tacoma. Today we talk some more about the fallacies that riddle recent supplemental environmental impact statements for the Kalama methanol refinery and the Tacoma LNG facility. This time our guest is Pete Erickson with Stockholm Environment Institute, who prepared a discussion brief last year on the climate implications of the proposed methanol refinery. Pete is a senior scientist in the Seattle office of the Stockholm Environmental Institute, where he leads the climate policy team. His research focuses on the connection between fossil fuel infrastructure and climate change. Pete, welcome to Locus Focus.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
Well, last year about this time, I was at a meeting in Kalama about the methanol refinery that is being proposed, and people were circulating this document that came from the Stockholm Environment Institute about, particularly about methane leakage that would be happen as a result if that facility was built. And I was kind of curious about this Stockholm Environment Institute and, you know, why were they so concerned about Kalama, Washington? So tell me, first of all, what is the Stockholm Environment Institute and how did you get involved in actually doing research on the proposed methanol refinery in Kalama?
Yeah, I love it. And I can see why that would have been a little confusing to hear about Stockholm in Kalama. Stockholm Environment Institute is a global environmental think tank, essentially. Our mission is to bridge science and policy in the fields of environment and global development. We've been around for about 30 years. We are headquartered in Stockholm, as you might imagine, but we have offices around the world, including the one that I lead here in Seattle. So we focus on really the technical aspects of climate change policy here, how to translate the global climate limits and the need to get off fossil fuels into practical policy steps and look at what that means. And a big part of what we do is focus on, rigorous analysis. We've worked with state governments, national governments, international governments for decades now on these issues. And when this issue of the Kalama methanol facility crossed our desk, 18 months ago or so, it was very clear to us that something wasn't right in the way they were doing the analysis. And though we don't, usually get involved in, local, environmental impact proceedings per se, in this case, we felt like there was something that just really wasn't right, and we needed to get involved and help tell the more accurate story about gas.
So what really wasn't right in that report?
The original environmental impact statement for the Kalama methanol facility essentially assumed that there was no greenhouse gas emissions associated with producing the gas that would be used at the facility and converted to methanol. And they had some very tortured logic for why that was, but regardless, the fact is that gas is mainly methane. Methane is a very highly potent greenhouse gas in its own right, much more potent than carbon dioxide, which is what we hear about more often. And some of that methane, that gas, escapes. It leaks. So, little things go wrong in the process from producing it, wherever it's produced, in Canada, in the U.S., anywhere, and getting it to where it's used. And even if very small amounts of it leak, because it is so potent as a greenhouse gas, it's important to take that into account whenever you're making claims about the climate implications of a gas project.
Well, about the same time as I saw your report, I also was down in Salem for a rally to oppose the Jordan Cove major production down in Southern Oregon. And there was a representative from a group called Oil Change International who gave the keynote address for this rally. And he was basically citing a lot of the same data that you had in your report. I'm kind of wondering, how did you both, these different organizations, both wind up with getting pretty similar data about methane leakage?
I know the report you're referring to. I haven't looked at it in quite some time. But there's a scientific community that is regularly publishing in major scientific journals about methane loss, and it's not hard to find those studies, right? I mean, if you're following along with that scientific literature, there's sort of 2 to 5, papers, major studies that come out each year that are worth paying attention to. So it's not a surprise to me that we both found found those studies, essentially.
So you said that the logic in the original environmental impact statement for the Kalama Methanol Refinery used some tortured logic to come to the conclusion that there was going to be no methane leakage. What do you mean by tortured methods?
Well, they were saying that, no new gas production was going to be needed to produce the gas for the facility. So think about that for a minute. They're saying that they're going to use as much gas at this facility that's equivalent to a third of all of Washington's current gas use. So that's a lot of gas. They're essentially saying that they're going to be able to use that gas without pulling any more gas out of the ground. It just doesn't add up, right?
Do they have any foundation for that? I mean, do they show any kind of figures that would support that conclusion?
Well, yes. Here, what they do is they say, there's already enough gas being produced to supply this facility. We're going to get gas from those places. And on the face of it, that kind of makes sense, except that when you realize that gas is a market commodity, lots of companies are using gas. And if Kalama claims a particular kind of gas for itself, that means someone else doesn't get that gas, which means that, there's new gas being developed somewhere else. So it's all connected, and in a sense, they were arguing that, they were special in some way. They were going to get to use existing gas fields. But even that doesn't make sense on the face of it, because they're building a project to last many decades. Gas fields that are already producing right now are not going to be around in several decades. So ultimately, new gas wells are going to need to be drilled to support this project.
Well, one of the things that's kind of interesting to me, actually, is that a lot of the opponents to any of these gas projects that are being proposed in the Northwest talk about how there's this rush to get this gas to market because there's a window that's closing, and basically because of, well, if we were actually to pay attention to the concerns of climate change, we would be getting off gas really fast, but that the renewables are going to replace fossil fuel very soon. And so the gas companies are trying to get all this gas on the market. And I've heard actually some activists say that the gas is so plentiful right now, especially coming out of British Columbia and Alberta, that they basically are going to give it away. So in a way, that would bolster NWIW, the company that wants to build a methanol refinery. It would bolster their claim that they're not going to be using any new gas.
Oh, I see. Yes, but those new fields in British Columbia and elsewhere are being developed because there is demand for it. So they don't have to be developed, those fields. They're only going to be developed if there's some need for it, if there's some market for it.
And this is where, this is sort of where I step at night, kind of worrying about things and trying to figure it out, because there's these two poles. There's the one, people who are really understanding climate change, at least in my opinion, who understand that we have to really leave all this stuff in the ground, that even though it's still there, for one thing, it's getting more and more expensive and dangerous to extract. And secondly, it's just putting all kinds of carbon in the atmosphere. So we need to leave it in there. And then there's other people, and this is my take on it, that they use the claim that natural gas is benign and green and much cleaner than coal, and therefore we need to use that as a bridge fuel to somewhere in the distant future. So how do we kind of pull those two opinions apart and kind of look at what is really going on?
No, that's a great question, and you probably won't be surprised that I'm somewhere in between those poles, but let's unpack each of those logics for a minute. It is totally true that gas can displace coal, and coal is more carbon intensive than gas. A big reason why U.S. greenhouse gas emissions went down in the last 5 years or so is because gas helped displace coal. That is the bridge fuel theory, that in this transition to a deeper, lower carbon renewable energy supply, that we need gas to help knock out coal. There is absolute truth to that, especially in the U.S. There is then the flip side, that to meet global climate goals, and those are very serious, to keep emissions within 2 degrees, we need to reduce fossil fuel CO2 emissions by 4% per year, and to meet the goal of 1.5 degrees, both of these goals, 1.5 and 2, have been signed on by all countries that committed to the Paris Agreement, including the U.S. The U.S. is still in, despite what you've heard. So either way, 4% per year, 10% per year, that's a massive scale of reduction of CO2 emissions, and most fossil fuels under that limit, you know, are going to need to be left undeveloped. Doesn't mean all, doesn't mean every single fossil fuel project needs to end immediately, but we do need by mid-century to get off fossil fuels more or less completely.
And so how do these plans for the big three frack gas projects being proposed in the Northwest, how does this affect our ability to get off fossil fuel by, let's say, 2050?
So let's take Jordan Cove LNG, really most LNG projects that are being developed to ship gas to Asian markets. That's where the bridge fuel question really comes to the fore, because is China going to be developing, and other, you know, particularly Southeast Asian countries, are they going to be building new coal plants? Or if we supply them with gas for power, would they instead use that with some climate benefit? Or, and here's the kicker, would the gas instead be displacing their building of new renewables? So the question of whether gas is the climate benefit or not really hinges on whether you think it's more likely to displace coal or instead to displace renewables.
And that gets into one of the big sticking points. I guess we should probably start to talk about what happened to that EIS for Calama and where we are at now with the new supplemental environmental impact statement. So did your paper, when you got involved last year with the Calama methanol refinery, the Shoreline Board had already pulled the permit for the Shoreline permit for Calama and was requiring a supplemental impact statement. Is that correct?
Well, when we published our paper, that's true, but I provided some testimony to the Shoreline Hearings Board before our paper came out.
And so when the SEIS, the Supplementary Environmental Impact Statement, came out, what was your reaction to that?
The acronyms are, so the new one that came out.
Yeah, the DSEIS, yes.
Yes, thank you. They corrected the major error that we talked about before. So a few minutes ago, we talked about how the original EIS for the Calama project basically said there was no methane loss associated with the gas sent to Calama. The new one took a very detailed look at it. I say detailed because they have a lot of numbers, a lot of tables, a lot of citations. I do not think, though, that they took an accurate look at it by any means. They used very selective read and incomplete read of the literature on how methane escapes from natural gas production systems.
So what kind of impact did that have on their conclusions, which I think were, by the time the methanol SEIS came out, people were beyond being astonished. But when a very similar supplementary environmental impact statement was proposed for the Tacoma LNG facility in October, That was when I think the shock came out. So, what was the what were their conclusions about the net greenhouse gas effect of these both of these projects?
Yeah, let's break it down and focus a bit on this methane question, and then maybe we can zoom out again, and you can be the guide of how quickly we zoom. Essentially, the assessments of both the Tacoma LNG and the Klamath methanol were, when they were done by the same consultant, they found, they used as their central case that of all the gas, you know, produced at from the wells, 0.3% of it gets lost along the way. When I say along the way, I mean from the production wells to the pipes that compress it and send it around, to the, you know, longer pipes that send it across the state down to wherever it's going. So 0.3%. Now, the scientific papers that have come out in the last few years put the rate of methane loss just about an order of magnitude higher. There was a big major assessment that itself reviewed many other papers that was published in the journal Science last summer, and it found a methane loss rate of, on average, for North American natural gas systems of 2.3%. So that's many times higher than 0.3%. And when you're talking about a gas that is 34 times as potent as carbon dioxide, that has a big impact on your conclusion about the overall greenhouse gas emissions associated with either the Tacoma LNG or the Klamath methanol facility.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Pete Erickson, senior scientist in the Seattle office at the Stockholm Environment Institute, where he leads the climate policy team. So what does this mean in terms of, you're talking about like the standard figure that's generally accepted in scientific circles is almost 10 times higher than what was in the life cycle analysis for the draft SEIS for both Tacoma and Klamath. What does that mean in terms of the of what they're missing, let's say, in your eyes?
Well, I think they're still missing a huge emission source from the facility, and it really would change their assertion about whether this project is a climate benefit or not. They are making very strong claims that the Klamath methanol project would be a net win for the climate. And if you take a wide-eyed look at what methane is being lost in the production of the gas that they're going to be used, their claim doesn't really hold up. And the reason it doesn't hold up is even more complicated than that. But in a sense, they're saying that they are going to be able to make plastics. That's the end destination of this methanol. But they're going to be able to make plastics with less greenhouse gas intensity. In other words, each kilogram of plastic is going to release less kilograms of carbon dioxide all along the life cycle than whatever the alternative is. And in the global market, the main other way that plastics are made is by using oil, not gas. And the main way that it is made, makes less greenhouse gases all along the life cycle than in the Klamath case. So that, you know, it essentially would change if they took a more accurate look at what methane is being lost upstream, it would change their calculation of the greenhouse gas benefit relative to the alternative.
Well, I found it interesting back in, I guess it was last June, I was talking with Lou Paulson at the Port of Tacoma, and we were talking about the fact that both the Tacoma LNG facility and the methanol refinery into Klamath were being required to do these life cycle analyses from cradle to grave. And he thought it was a little bit odd that a jurisdiction would have to worry about emissions from some other jurisdiction, like why they have no control of it. But then he sort of contradicted himself by saying, but I am pretty confident. I mean, won't it be interesting if the SEIS comes back for Kalama and it proves that it's a net greenhouse gas emission loss because of the fact that they're replacing so much greenhouse gas emissions from using coal to make olefins in China. And when the actual document came out, I thought, I wondered if the port of Tacoma had like any kind of sneak preview of what the thinking was of Life Cycle Associates who did that life cycle analysis.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't have any special insight onto who might have known what when, except that, this was the main claim of the proponents of the facility going back, you know, many years now, is that this was going to be the thing that displaced coal. So they never had that in the original EIS. It was only in their marketing materials and in their, public website and such. So now they've, tried to put the math behind it.
So it's kind of an interesting thing. When they first put out the initial environmental impact statement, it seemed like what was the rationale then for building this facility? Because if it wasn't to displace coal in China, then what was their reasoning?
That's an interesting question. Well, I think what you're saying is, why didn't they bring it up before?
Right, yeah. If it's so important now.
Yeah. My sense is that they were trying to take the narrowest view of what an environmental impact statement is that they could get away with, right? They were trying to sort of fly below the radar in that, and the Shoreline Hearings Board said, you have to take a bigger view, and so then they really dug in on that, on the bigger view.
Well, I'm kind of curious, where did their data that they came up with a 0.3% methane leakage rate from gas coming from British Columbia? This was the other thing, was you have to use gas from British Columbia because they have the highest efficiency and the lowest leakage rate. Where did those figures come from?
This is an interesting story in itself, which is that they cite a few different sources for that figure, all of which have flaws, but the one they lean most heavily on is a model. It's really just a big spreadsheet, a collection of whole bunch of numbers, but a model called GH Genius that was, I think, commissioned originally by both the British Columbia government and the government of Canada. And yet the version that they cite is no longer available from the consultant. It's a different consultant that made it, nor is it available from the government of British Columbia. Anyway, to make that story a little shorter, essentially, if you crack open that spreadsheet and you also read the documentation, it turns out that 0.3% leakage number comes from the oil industry, the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, from a greenhouse gas inventory that they did in the year 2000, in which they went out and estimated and measured the methane leakage from a few specific pieces of equipment and came up with a 0.3% number. Now, as I explained earlier, the science of how methane gets lost from natural gas systems has grown huge amounts since 2000, and that is essentially what the consultants for the Kalama facility and the supplemental EIS are missing out on.
Well, the other part is interesting is I heard a lot of talk both in Tacoma at the public hearing for the SEIS for the LNG facility and in Longview for the hearing for the Kalama methanol refinery, that there was mention of the study that was cited in the life cycle analysis that was done by, I think, Brandt et al. And there was some questions about whether that was actually a study. So let's talk a little bit about that one.
Yeah, so that's one of the other studies that they point to for this 0.3% number. They say, oh, yeah, look, these other scientists much more recently found the same number, therefore 0.3% must be right. So let's unpack that a little bit. They cite, as you mentioned, a study called Brandt et al., which doesn't actually really exist yet. Brandt et al. Was a PowerPoint presentation from a seminar at Stanford that the consultant found that has since been taken down, and in which Brandt et al., you know, cited a very low methane loss rate from this very particular facility in British Columbia. I think it's, you know, referred to in the EIS as 7G or G7 or Seven Generations facility. Now, actually, it's not in British Columbia. It's in Alberta. That's the first problem, but that one doesn't bother me so much. What bothers me more is that this study, and I'm looking at the underlying study here in my hand, which they sent me. It's essentially a master's degree thesis project where the researchers had specific access to this brand new facility at specific times and were able to go in and do some, you know, own measurements of the equipment. And, you know, they came up with something pretty similar to what the industry came up with in that year 2000 study. And, you know, that's not really a surprise. When you have access to a facility and they know you're coming and it's brand new and they know everything's working, you know, pretty much as designed, to come up with a low methane loss rate is interesting. It's good to know that hasn't changed that much over the years. But again, it's under ideal conditions when they've let you be there. And what the science has found in the last 18 years, you know, since the original oil industry study that is in the GH Genius model, what the science has found since, and the way they do this is they fly airplanes over big gas fields, you know, day in, day out for a long period of time, and in so doing, with very particular, very sensitive equipment, they can capture, they can estimate all the methane that escapes, not just the methane that leaks out of, you know, particular seals under ideal conditions. And that's when they find that actual methane loss is 10, 15, 17 times higher than measured under ideal conditions. So this is all to say that study, the so-called Brandt et al. Study, is a, you know, no doubt a good piece of scientific work, but it is not at all indicative of conditions that could be expected over the long term or over all facilities in British Columbia. And furthermore, that study hasn't, you know, been published yet or gone through peer review. And peer review is the scientific, you know, what the scientific community uses to say, okay, we're ready to hold up this result for the world yet. So it really shouldn't have been included in the EIS.
So what does it say to you about this draft supplemental environmental impact statement and its accompanying life cycle analysis that the sources of data, what do you think about how the sources of data that they use and the way that they're embedded in the report reflect on the accuracy of that report?
Well, you know, I always want to view things at face value as a scientist and not try to assume or project any ill intent. That said, the data that they've relied on all point to a very specific story that is very much at odds with what science has found. Science that has taken a broader view of this question, what that's found more recently. So it's odd to me that they would put so much emphasis on these very low methane loss rates when that just is not supportable.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Pete Erickson, who's a senior scientist in the Seattle office of Stockholm Environment Institute. And we're talking about the flaws in the draft supplemental environmental impact statements for the methanol refinery proposed for Kalama, Washington, and the massive LNG facility being proposed for Tacoma. This could look like a case of dueling science from a certain perspective. And that's the way it's sort of been, I think, portrayed in some of the media, and also the way that Northwest Innovation Works, who wants to build the methanol refinery, portrays it. So what would you respond in terms of, is this just dueling science, like they used to say climate change was back in 2002? Or is there one side that is really has the evidence on its side and the other side has some other kinds of motivations?
Yeah. I mean, if I'm not sure what would be dueling here. It's really just clear that they haven't used the latest numbers. They haven't taken a wide-eyed view of what the methane implications are here. And, you know, there's any number of papers in the very prominent peer-reviewed journals that point to different conclusions than they found. So it's not a one side, other side story in my mind when it comes to this methane loss question.
Well, I had an interesting conversation with a representative from Northwest Innovation Works a few weeks ago. I was actually trying to get an interview with him, and he told me that they see me as being on the other side, so they didn't want to talk to me. But he said, you should talk to the scientists. And so I said, I was trying to think, what scientists do you mean? And he basically meant the person or the people who wrote the life cycle analysis for the draft environmental impact statement, and also somebody from an organization that I'd never heard of called the Low Carbon Prosperity Institute up in Seattle. And I did talk to him, actually. And when I was talking to the representative from NWIW, and I asked him who these scientists were, and he basically equated, I said, well, isn't that who was paid for, who NWIW paid to write this report? And so I was questioning just the objectivity of it. And he says, well, that's not any different than Stockholm Environment Institute. They were paid by Columbia Riverkeeper to do what they're doing. So how would you frame that?
Well, look, we are a 501c3 nonprofit research organization in the U.S., part of a much larger international NGO that's been doing this for three decades. All of our work we put out in the public domain to be critiqued. We publish in the peer-reviewed scientific literature many times per year, and our work stands on its own. So it's, you know, we put it up in front of the scientific community to peer review, to have it be critiqued. And that is what science does. That is what science is for. And it's, you know, very clear to me that the EIS done by these consultants would not pass that standard, that threshold. So, I think I'll leave it at that.
Well, you know, we're in this period of time right now where, I mean, I think we've gone through the looking glass of 1984, where truth is lies and lies are truth, and everything is kind of whatever you want to say it is. And particularly around science, I remember there's very striking testimony made by a professor at the University of Puget Sound at the Tacoma LNG hearing on October 30th this past year, where he basically, he'd been sitting through the entire hearing, and I watched him as he was like rewriting his testimony to respond to whatever somebody had said. And one of the things that by the time he gave his testimony very late in the evening that was driving him crazy, actually, was all these people who got up in support of the LNG facility who talked about science and how the science backed this up. And so he basically, in his 3 minutes, gave a brief explanation of how peer review goes, what it means, what science really involves, the whole scientific method. And I wonder if that's something that you've thought about in terms of what you're trying to put out and understanding, getting people to understand what the scientific method is, which is something I learned in seventh grade general science, but maybe they don't teach it anymore, I don't know. But that the proponents of these facilities are saying that they're using science, but how can that be successfully debated?
Well, that's a great question, and I think, I mean, what does it mean to use science? Sure, you can use science, and then you can abuse it, and what's the, you know, where's the line between those things? I think where the EIS for the new one for Kelowna Methanol Facility really breaks down to me in terms of the scientific method really is in its transparency. It, you know, spreads its calculations out over dozens and dozens of pages, and it's really hard to follow. I think that, you know, any peer reviewer, if this were to be submitted, you know, to that, would say, well, you know, can you just break it down? What are your few simple assumptions that are leading to this? Don't hide behind this GH genius model, for example. And, you know, in terms of this methane loss, there's really only a few numbers that you need to put out there to let someone, let a peer reviewer say, understand what it is you're doing and what it is you're getting at. I mean, those numbers are, how much gas are you using? And I'll note that number is hard to find in the EIS. How much of that gas is being lost along the way? That number is hard to find. Well, they put out a whole bunch of numbers, so it becomes a little bit difficult to understand exactly which one they used. And then lastly, how intense is that gas, the methane, as a global warming agent? Those are, you know, when you really boil it down, those are the three numbers, and there are flaws at each step in their analysis. We haven't even talked about the last one yet. How potent is methane?
Well, let's talk about that, and then I actually wanted to talk some more about the critique that was made of your assessment, as well as of the SEIS that was made by the Low Carbon Prosperity Institute. But let's talk first of all about the global warming potential of methane. And first, you should explain what does global warming potential mean.
Yeah. Global warming potential is essentially a number that scientists have come up with for each different type of greenhouse gas. In other words, each really molecule that contributes in a major way to climate change has different warming potential because of what it does in the atmosphere, essentially. Methane is very potent. It leads to a lot of warming, but then it decays very quickly. So it leads to a lot of warming in the short term, not so much in the long term. Anyway, there are, you know, a dozen, say, very prominent greenhouse gases, and each one is characterized by scientists in terms of its global warming potential. Sometimes that's shortened to GWP, and that is simply a ratio of how much warming over a specific time period does the gas lead to compared to, as a ratio to, CO2. So the most recent IPCC, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that's the international body that is in charge of looking at these things, they have estimated that methane is 34 times more potent than carbon dioxide over a 100-year time frame. That's what GWP is. It turns out that the EIS for Kelowna Methanol and for many of these projects, including Tacoma LNG, use an older number for the global warming potential of methane of something, I forget exactly, I think it's 25. So they use a number from the IPCC's previous report. So they are underestimating the contribution of methane to global warming.
Now let's talk a bit about the justification. When we talked in Seattle a couple of weeks ago, you surmised what it was, and then I talked to the author of the Low Carbon Prosperity Institute report that basically critiqued your report, as well as basically just reiterating what was said in the SEIS. And he said actually what you thought he might think, which was that they use that number because that's the number that's used by states and countries to be consistent with what they've been using all along. So why don't you explain that and why that's not necessary to use an older number in the situation when you're dealing with the methanol refinery?
Right. So there's a different international body, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. That's where the negotiations happen and where countries have to submit their greenhouse gas inventories, and they, you know, have done so since 1990. And in that forum, having everyone use exactly the same rules and using the same rules over time is important, because if you were to change those rules, and, you know, there might be good reasons to change them, but just nonetheless, if you change them, countries have to go back and recalculate their prior greenhouse gas inventories. And there are lots of, you know, small, less wealthy countries where, you know, that could be a burden to just ask them to recalculate something. Furthermore, as long as you're using the same method year in and year out, you're still getting a good, even if it's slightly wrong, you're still getting a good comparable signal over time to tell whether your emissions are increasing or decreasing. So in that framework, in the UNFCCC, countries are still using the prior numbers for global warming potential for methane and other gases. And so as a result, you know, some U.S. states follow that lead too, because the states want their numbers to add up to the national total. That is for a greenhouse gas inventory. That's just a static look at what emissions are at a certain point in time. There is literally no reason why, in looking at a specific project now, this is not a greenhouse gas inventory, it's just looking at and trying to make an honest assessment of the environmental impacts of a particular project today in 2019, you should use the latest science. And in that regard, the latest science is the updated IPCC numbers from what's called the fifth assessment report. And it's this 34 number that I've been talking about over 100-year time span. And, you know, that hopefully makes sense to you, but there are other bodies, you know, when groups of carbon geeks have gotten together in a process called the Greenhouse Gas Protocol, they've said the same thing. When you're looking at the effect of a particular action, like building a new facility, you don't need to be bound by whatever the national accounting rules are. For your GWPs, you should use the latest science.
Well, one of the things that puzzled me in the conversation I had with the author of the report from the Low Carbon Prosperity Institute, well, he basically was saying that in the life cycle analysis that was done for Kalama and for Tacoma, that the lowest figures that you cite were in there in what he called the sensitivity analysis. And I couldn't quite figure out what he meant by sensitivity analysis or where you'd find it. But I'm wondering, are you familiar with that? And do you know where the sensitivity analysis was in the document?
Oh, gosh, I do have the document on my desk. I do know that there's a sensitivity analysis in there. I think they do look at the higher GWP, but their sensitivity analysis is that they vary, you know, a whole bunch of parameters simultaneously. So it's hard to really understand, you know, what happened, the result of any individual parameter.
And he was saying that he thought it should have been highlighted more. And this is the author of this critique. And that was one of his criticisms of the SEIS, that it was hard to find these higher figures that he says would probably give more scientific credibility to the report. But it's in there, so don't worry, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, I have a problem with that, because it does seem like they've tried to put a tiny bit of everything, every other perspective in there in these sensitivity analysis in order to sort of cover themselves. But when it comes to the top line findings, what they really use as their main conclusions, you know, they don't use those much more accurate figures.
So what does a sensitivity analysis mean? Because I haven't gone back and looked at the document since I interviewed this guy, but I just remember when I was trying to read both documents,
yeah.
I got lost a lot and was really pretty hard to figure out where I was.
A sensitivity analysis is a very important, you know, thing to do in a scientific discipline where you're trying, you know, you're coming up with an estimate of something that is pretty uncertain. There's lots of different ways to do a sensitivity analysis, from, you know, super math heavy ways to more just showing what you know, a different outcome could be. But the basic gist of it is to, you know, is asking the question, well, what if it isn't quite the way we think it is? What if these different parameters were adjusted a little bit different way? How sensitive, that's the origin of the term sensitivity analysis, how sensitive is our main result to these other parameters? And in that regard, I don't think they really did a true sensitivity analysis, because they, you know, even the one that they did was pretty obtuse, and seemed to lead to conclusions that align with their main conclusion. For example, I think, I need to go back and confirm, but the sensitivity analysis for methane, they said that if they used it, the higher methane, that the facility would have even more benefit, because it would displace methane from coal production in China, and there would be somehow more methane displaced than would be added in North America from the extra gas. But when they've so underestimated the gas in North America, that conclusion is very unlikely to be accurate, because producing gas, which is mainly methane, leads to more methane loss than producing coal, which is definitively not mainly methane.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Pete Erickson, who's a senior scientist in the Seattle office of the Stockholm Environment Institute. And we're talking about the flaws in the supplemental environmental impact statement for the methanol refinery that's proposed for Kalama. One of the things that was interesting, I was actually, the last couple of days, I've been editing the interview I did with you and the interview I did with Kevin Tempest from the Low Carbon Prosperity Institute. And I kind of came to the conclusion that his final analysis was that there's a lot of uncertainty about methane leakage in the upstream portion of the project, of the report, and upstream meaning between the fracking wells and the methanol refinery, and the downstream, which is what happens in China. So there's a lot of uncertainty in the upstream, but the downstream, like knowing that it's going to be replacing coal in the process of making olefins for plastic, that has certainty. It seems to me you have exactly the opposite opinion about the upstream and downstream uncertainties.
That's an interesting way to put it. And I guess you're kind of right about that, because we know, I mean, there's been, you know, dozens of scientific studies, including ones in Canada that we haven't even talked about yet, that show how much higher methane loss is than industry-provided estimates. So we know methane loss is somewhere on the order of, you know, 2%. Maybe it's 1.5% at best, and maybe it's 3% or 3.5% at worst. But, you know, speaking of sensitivity analysis, anywhere along that spectrum is a lot higher than what the proponents are saying. So, you know, yeah, there's some uncertainty, but the band is pretty well defined. On the downstream end, what it displaces, it's a whole different kind of uncertainty. I mean, you're talking about how these global fossil fuel markets evolve, and, you know, they're picking out coal as the thing that's being displaced. Well, coal is a very small fraction of the overall methanol market, and it's an even smaller fraction of the overall olefin or plastics market. So to pick out something that's not the major global pathway for making these plastics and say, oh no, that's the thing that we're going to knock off with our new gas-based methanol plant in Kalama, that is also not a wide-eyed view of what this facility could likely lead to. In our view, if you're going to take that perspective, you should look at all the other things that might also be displaced. It could displace other gas-based methanol from other sources. It could displace all these other oil-based routes of making plastics. And there's also the possibility that it doesn't go to plastics at all, because methanol markets are global and they're all connected. So if you're adding more methanol to a methanol market and some methanol goes to plastics, that's fine, but some methanol goes to vehicle fuel too. And the proponents of the facility adamantly assert that this is not going to vehicle fuel, but there's no way of knowing that in the long term it's not. I believe even that, you know, some of the higher-ups at the company in China that would be brokering this methanol have actually stated that it could very well go to vehicle fuel. So you need to look at that question, too. And if you add up all the different scenarios of how the methanol could be used in the global markets, there are some that have a few that have a very high GHG benefit, in other words, displacing coal. There are a whole bunch that are kind of GHG neutral, and then there are some that are GHG bad. And if you kind of take an average of that big pile of smush, you know, you still end up with something that, you know, you kind of have to shrug your shoulders about and say, well, it could be a tiny bit good, but it's more likely to be a tiny bit bad. And in the scheme of things, when you're trying to get off fossil fuels at 10% per year, as we said earlier, does this facility not just lock in a fossil fuel-based pathway that then becomes harder to get off in the long term?
Well, in the remaining moments that we have, I want to talk about greenwashing, which is probably something we could talk about for a full hour. But I was talking with Annette Bryan, who is on the Tribal Council of the Puyallup Tribe in Tacoma last week, and she said to me a couple times that natural gas is the new nicotine. And you mentioned when I talked to you a couple of weeks ago about, you quoted Naomi Oreste and her whole thing about the merchants of doubt. So I like to sort of frame this whole push to get more, quote, natural gas on the market, and that it's safe and it's green and the way it's being promoted that way, to the kinds of promotions and advertising and strange science that went into promoting nicotine as a safe substance for many, many years before that finally was turned around.
Yeah, interesting. Or another example might be vaping. Is vaping displacing nicotine, or is it creating new users?
Well,
I mean by that is, yeah, you know, gas could be worse than coal, but it's a lot worse than. Gas could be better than coal, but it's a lot worse than not using fossil fuels at all. And, you know, at this time when we really need to be getting off them so completely, does it make sense to do more of gas? Not convinced.
Well, one of the things I'm thinking about is the way that it's being promoted, because this is the conundrum that I've been really struggling with for a couple months now, is how to counter the propaganda. Every hearing that I go to and I hear the proponents for these facilities get up, and the first thing they say is, I'm an environmentalist, and I care more about the environment than these opponents of this facility, which are really just trying to keep themselves in business by opposing these things, and they're opposing progress, and they don't care if people in China breathe bad air. And there's this whole litany of ways in which everything just gets turned around to where the people who, in my view, are proposing, are supporting projects that would really harm the environment, they're the environmentalists in their eyes, and the people like Columbia Riverkeeper and 350 and all the people who are fighting fossil fuel and have been fighting it for a long time are the anti-environmentalists, because they're in the way of progress. And these people are promoting natural gas as the progress we need at this moment. So I kind of wanted to get beneath that rhetoric, yeah, and kind of look at, you know, how is this being framed and why is it being framed that way and how do we counter it?
Well, look, there's no big money to be made in being an environmentalist, and I'm no doubt Columbia Riverkeeper is doing this because they care about the local issues of the river and they care about the global issues of the climate. On the flip side, there are large profits to be made in the fossil fuel industry, and you know, those have been shown over time through history, that those actors have, you know, misled the public time and time again on these issues. And that is what just the research shows in terms of when you look at what the industry has said publicly compared to what they know privately about the role of fossil fuels in climate change. So there, you know, there should be a high bar for research and for science on these issues, and that bar has been met in terms of gas, you know, not really having a future in a deeply low carbon world. So it's you know, it to some degree it's a matter of perspective, but really, if you care about in any sense an equitable, safer climate, you know, gas needs to be ramped down in the long term.
Well, Pete, it's really great to talk to you, and my mind is reeling about many things we can talk about in the future.
So, yeah.
I mean, I think that this whole issue around greenwashing is really one of the things that we have to look at, because I think that people who are opposing all these fossil fuel projects can sometimes get kind of caught up in the snares, because like Northwest Innovation Works is now being very good at painting itself as a green machine. And I guess final thing is, like, how do we look at that and be able to reflect it back to them that maybe they're not what they're saying they are?
You know, I'm a scientist. The way I know how to do it is through fact and reason, and so that's my take here. I mean, I think ultimately, if we're going to have a low carbon pathway, we're going to need to think bigger about this and make hard choices about what is really consistent with that. And, you know, ultimately take the kind of perspective that, you know, the Green New Deal is offering, which is that, you know, there are things that are very clearly part of a low carbon pathway, and we can have economic prosperity around those things. And these are big societal choices that we have to make, and we should make them. So maybe that's that. There's one whole other topic to talk about.
Okay. Well, maybe we should do this soon, because these really are things that I just keep thinking about every night. So we've got lots more to talk about.
Okay,
well, thanks so much for joining us, Pete.
I really appreciate it.
And have fun walking home in the snow. Today we've been talking with Pete Erickson, who's senior scientist in the Seattle office of the Stockholm Environment Institute, where he leads the climate policy team. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, KBOO.fm/locus-focus. Next week, my guest is Portland's newest city council member, Joanne Hardesty. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Joni Mitchell. Thanks for listening. Sex sells everything.